The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Time Magazine December 29, 2025 edition. The cover of the Time Magazine is bordered in red, as usual, with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in kind of a blue-gray, not very dark. It's superimposed upon a light blue-gray background. The top caption reads, and this is also in capital letters, Person of the Year, the Architects of AI. And instead of a photograph or other image of one person, it's of some kind of a giant scaffold. And it looks like one, two, three, four, about five, six stairways to the top, which is empty. But it's just really scaffolding. It's very structural. And there are lots of people dotting each section of this structural edifice or building. It's not a building. There's no roof. There's no door. It's just open air architecture, it looks like. But there are groups of people. Some are wearing yellow hard hats. There are males and females, and some are in business attire, and some are in more casual attire. But at the center of this open air structure, which is basically scaffolding, we see the letters, also in capital, large block print, AI. And within the structure of those letters, there are also people wandering about or standing about, but there are also contraptions. I suppose they're supposed to depict computer components. There are hoses, electrical gear-like things. I'm just guessing they're computer components. Anyway, it's AI. So AI, the thing, is the person of the year according to Time. The first article, and these are rather unconventional as opposed to the usual format because it's focusing upon the person of the year. But there are persons of the year in various categories. Beginning with health, Unraveling Progress by Alice Park. In an era of fast-paced scientific advancements, it's easy to take medical gains for granted. We expect breakthroughs to occur on a regular basis, and 2025 delivered successful trials of gene therapies for diseases that have no treatments, for example, filled scientists and the public with hope. But bright spots like these were overshadowed by a series of political decisions in the U.S. that have already started to set public health care back instead of pushing it forward. The White House and the nation's top health agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, took a number of unprecedented actions in fundamental areas of public health. They kicked off the year with dismantling of USAID, shutting down programs that provide life-saving global health interventions, including childhood vaccinations. The administration then slashed budgets and personnel at the National Institutes of Health, one of the world's premier biomedical research centers and the springboard for innovations like the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines and immunotherapies for cancer. Meanwhile, despite the lack of any new data to justify skepticism, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, is now sowing doubt about the long-established safety of vaccines, which public health researchers say could lead to spikes in infectious diseases. The profound consequences of this year's retrenchments will be felt for years to come. Vaccines in the crosshairs. Many of the changes revolve around the Make America Healthy Again, MAHA agenda, and a mistrust of vaccines led by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine skeptic. Now, as an editorial aspect, this last phrase, the mistrust of vaccines, a longtime vaccine skeptic, is in bold type, unusual, except in captions. In the spring, HHS withdrew important investments in research into new mRNA vaccines, and Kennedy also announced on social media that the CDC would no longer recommend the yearly COVID vaccine for most Americans, which led some states to make their own guidelines, continuing to recommend these shots for residents and reimbursing the cost. In June, Kennedy fired members of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee and replaced them with people who question the safety of vaccines. In August, President Trump fired the CDC's newly appointed head, Susan Menares, when she clashed with Kennedy over his vaccine strategy. The administration also reinstated a previously disbanded task force to reinvestigate the safety of childhood vaccines, even though data show the shots are safe. Toward the end of the year, the CDC's website changed to state that the claim vaccines do not cause autism is not an evidence-based claim. Threats to future progress. Public health experts are vocally pushing back, citing decades of strong scientific evidence showing vaccines are safe and do not cause autism. The source of much of the evidence on which experts like these rely, not just about vaccines, but about every aspect of medicine, is scientific research funded by NIH. What is at stake when this foundation's resources are eroded and trust in science crumbles is the scientific knowledge that drives many medical decisions in the U.S., as well as the pipeline of innovative treatments for all types of diseases. Immunotherapies that save so many lives from cancer began with funding from the NIH. Again, that last phrase was in bold type. For example, they did several gene therapies that reported positive results for the first time this year in treating Huntington's disease, a rare genetic disease in newborns, and high cholesterol. These therapies and others could one day cure people of their conditions. Without the basic research that made advances like these possible, the stream of innovative treatments that could save both lives and healthcare costs could be reduced to a trickle in coming years, experts worry. And as people live longer, the protection from therapies scientists haven't even dreamed up yet may be more urgently needed than ever. Climate, the Fractured Agenda by Justin Warland. By the time negotiators from around the world gathered in the Amazonian city of Belém in November to discuss the future of climate action, the world had already experienced an alarming year. Near record global temperatures, unprecedented heat waves across continents, extreme flooding that scientists say would have been virtually impossible without human-driven warming. The UN COP30 climate conference was supposed to signal a global recommitment to cut emissions of greenhouse gases. Since oil, gas, and coal produce most of these, a group of countries pushed a plan to phase out fossil fuels. But in the face of opposition from oil and gas producers, the words fossil fuels did not appear in the final text. The COP30 outcome offers an illustration of the fractured, complicated state of climate action in 2025. Some countries continue moving forward when it aligns with short-term economic and political realities. Others, most importantly the U.S., have refused to participate entirely. When President Donald Trump took office in January, many feared a dramatic global pullback. Instead, we have entered a messy moment, with different countries pursuing a range of strategies based on perceived self-interest, and companies moving ahead with sustainability efforts when they advance the bottom line. At the end of the day, decarbonization will continue based purely on economics, but what that looks like from place to place varies wildly. At the same time, it is unclear how much of the growing cost of climate change can be avoided. After Trump's inauguration, many of the climate advocates' darkest fears were realized, and worse. Trump brought the offshore wind industry to a halt as his administration froze projects with pre-existing approvals. It cut federal support for electric vehicles, along with wind and solar power, as it worked with a Republican Congress to dismantle a law that subsidized clean technologies. And the administration launched an assault on the science of climate change with a Department of Energy report challenging its basic premises and, by extension, federal authority to address the issue. These efforts will be mitigated somewhat by economic realities. Power demand is growing in the U.S. for the first time in decades, driven in large part by the rapid growth in AI data centers, and renewable energy has become the lowest cost, easiest technology for utilities. At the same time, the U.S. retained some of its tax incentives for technologies like nuclear power and energy storage. Think of batteries. All of this means the U.S. is doing its own thing at home and abroad. Unlike those of many other developed countries, its emissions are expected to flatline instead of decline, and America's global climate influence will continue to dissipate as it steps back. But the U.S. is the source of only 12% of global emissions. Cheap renewables and storage mean more green energy around the globe. China has become a clean tech superpower and is keen to export its products. Chinese solar cell exports increased 73% in the first half of the year as prices hit record lows, according to data from energy think tank Ember. For countries eager to develop, renewables have become irresistible. All of these developments are happening against the backdrop of escalating climate disasters, and for that reason, the world has increasingly turned to the issue of climate adaptation. In climate lingo, that means taking preparatory measures and climate-proofing infrastructure. It's long been a debate among climate experts about how much to emphasize adaptation in comparison to cutting emissions. This year may have tipped the scales. Even in the best case scenario, we need to adapt, says David Sivaprasad, a climate-focused managing director at global consulting firm BCG. But the effectiveness of adaptation dramatically reduces once we get into more severe climate scenarios. In 2025, as costs began to stack, it's become increasingly clear that we will need a lot more of both. And the clock is ticking. Trump, last year's Person of the Year, spent 2025 testing the limits of his office, by Brian Bennett. Donald Trump had been waiting 4 years to get back to the Oval Office, and he arrived with a long to-do list. They came out of the gate like man-of-war, says Joseph Grogan, who served as director of Trump's domestic policy council during the first term. They set a blistering pace of administrative actions across all major agencies. On his first day alone, he pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, froze all foreign aid, suspended refugee admissions, granted clemency to more than 1,500 people charged in the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot that tried to overturn his 2020 election loss, and he was just getting started. Within a month, he had fired 17 inspectors general, allowed immigration agents to arrest people inside courthouses, taunted Denmark about handing over Greenland, announced steep tariffs on Canada and Mexico, and said the U.S. should own the Gaza Strip. Within two, he deported Venezuelan men to a notorious prison in El Salvador, declared English the country's official language, bawled out Ukraine's president in the Oval Office as cameras rolled. It was hard to keep up. Presidents typically sprint to get things done during their first year in office, while they can ride the momentum from a winning campaign. But Trump's pace as he returned to the White House was head-spinning. It is obvious the team knows they're in a hurry, Grogan says. Many of those working with Trump were frustrated with how often courts blocked major initiatives in his first term and how investigations and Trump's impeachment distracted from their work, Grogan says, and they're trying to make up for that. While Trump continued to court controversy, his team kept up relentless pace to enact his domestic agenda. They stripped away energy regulations in an effort to increase U.S. oil and gas production and gutted subsidies for wind and solar projects. They pushed out more than 300,000 civil servants, stripped away COVID vaccine requirements, froze research funding to major universities to pressure them to end diversity programs and hire more conservatives as faculty. During Trump's first term, he burned through a lot of time trying to get Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act. This time, Trump shifted his strategy. He prioritized tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy, and eventually insisted they be wrapped with a laundry list of his other agenda items, including ending green energy subsidies and massively expanding funding for border and immigration enforcement. Some Republicans balked at the strategy, but it worked. In July, Trump signed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act into law. The new funding for Trump's immigration agenda, a whopping $170 billion, was just one part of Trump's stark overhaul of the country's approach to immigration. He shut down a Biden-era program that allowed migrants to make an appointment at the border to request asylum and revoked temporary protective status for more than 675,000 people residing in the U.S. He then mobilized the Border Patrol and ICE, ICE agents, to make visible and often indiscriminate arrests in communities and ramped up deportations. Trump deployed the National Guard in Los Angeles to confront protests against his immigration actions and sent guard troops to Washington, D.C. and Memphis, saying it was to address crime. Daily life for migrants in communities across the country was upended. Border crossings between points of entry plummeted. Whereas Trump's immigration regime has been brutally consistent, his erratic use of tariffs roiled world and industry leaders. Stock markets endured a roller coaster spring as Trump dramatically announced historically high tariffs on dozens of trading partners and then postponed or rolled back many of them, frustrating both large and small business owners who've struggled with the uncertainty around what imports will cost. While Trump presented the tariffs as part of a plan to revive domestic manufacturing, he also used the threat of tariffs as a tool of international diplomacy. When India and Pakistan exchanged fire earlier this year, Trump claimed it was his threat of new tariffs that persuaded the two longtime adversaries to stand down. If I did not have the power of tariffs, you would have at least four of the seven wars raging, Trump said in the Oval Office October 6. Not only did we make hundreds of billions of dollars, but we're a peacekeeper because of tariffs. On the world stage, Trump also pressured European countries to invest more in their own militaries and to pay more for weapons shipments used for Ukraine's defense. He killed dozens in military strikes on alleged drug-smuggling boats on the Caribbean and Pacific that many decried as illegal and callous. He hit Iranian nuclear facilities, then declared an end to an aerial war between Israel and Iran. He persuaded Middle East states to back his ceasefire plan for Gaza, which required Hamas to return the remaining 20 living hostages kidnapped during the deadly October 7, 2023 attacks on Israel. On the campaign trail in 2024, Trump was not shy about saying he would use a second term to get revenge on his enemies. He followed through, sicking his Justice Department on longtime adversaries like former FBI Director James Comey and New York State Attorney General Letitia James, and targeting law firms that had previously conducted work or hired lawyers he did not like. The retribution campaign, along with a wide range of profitable business endeavors by Trump and his family, drew charges of an administration beset by corruption. At every turn, Trump used his knack for dominating news cycles to make himself the focus of attention all year, but identifying which efforts will be worthy of space in history books requires some sifting through the noise, says Whit Ayers, a longtime Republican strategist. He's taken more actions and made more news than any other president in my lifetime, in 1 year, but that news and those actions have not necessarily led to lasting accomplishments, says Ayers. Trump's approval rating started the year at 47%, according to Gallup polling, but has hovered near 40% since the summer. Ramping up deportations of immigrants who've lived in the U.S. for years is broadly unpopular. But voters give Trump credit for reducing the flow of illegal border crossing, says Ayers. It is quite an accomplishment that he's effectively shut down the southern border without spending a lot of money, Ayers says. Other Trump policies that have been popular with Americans, according to Ayers, are getting Europe to increase defense spending, negotiating the ceasefire in Gaza, and addressing concerns about transgender athletes competing in youth sports. But voters were less positive on Trump's first year overall. Millions turned out in cities across the country for anti-Trump No Kings protests in June and October. The off-cycle elections in New Jersey and Virginia were a disaster for Republicans, as many voters who pulled the lever for Trump in 2024 backed Democrats, who promised to do more to address high prices and push back on Trump's chaotic leadership. With the midterm elections coming in 2026, Trump and Republicans will make reversing public sentiment a priority. How Trump addresses the issues topping most polls, the economy, and the increasing cost of living could define his second year in office. Now to one of the several cover stories that Time has offered. Person of the Year, Ideas, How the U.S. Can Lead, by Eric Schmidt. Artificial intelligence is reshaping the world. Who controls the reshaping, and under what conditions, remains far from settled. The past year has made clear the race ahead is actually multiple overlapping contests unfolding at once. The first is between the U.S. and China. American frontier labs continue to lead the push toward artificial intelligence, AGI, investing extraordinary sums to build systems that could equal or surpass human cognition. The stakes are immense. AGI could shift the global balance of power and generate unprecedented economic growth. China, however, is pursuing a different path and believes that widespread AI adoption will deliver the greatest gains. Its AI Plus initiative targets 90% integration across key sectors by 2030, with a particular focus on AI-enabled manufacturing. The early results are striking. An Edelman poll found 60% of Chinese employees use AI at least weekly, compared with 37% of American workers. While the U.S. positions its economy to build the most powerful AI systems, China is deploying AI to build the most powerful economy. The U.S. and China are not the only forces shaping the global landscape. The European Union, seeking to lead through governance rather than innovation, adopted the world's first comprehensive AI law in 2024. But uneven enforcement and a growing list of exceptions have created a regulatory morass that is stifling the continent's transformation. Gulf states are charting a different course as Saudi Arabia and the UAE invest hundreds of billions of dollars in data center infrastructure, positioning themselves as critical nodes in the AI boom. Another competition is unfolding over the architecture of AI itself, open versus closed systems. The U.S. has historically championed technological openness, yet much of its AI leadership now centers on proprietary models. Meanwhile, open source momentum is accelerating elsewhere. In January, Chinese company DeepSeek, that's one word, released its R1 model, demonstrating that companies can build highly capable models without top-tier chips, a reminder that cheap and adaptable models may spread fastest globally. The U.S. can remain the global AI leader in 2026 only if it competes on all fronts. Consolidating its advantage in frontier AI will require solving the energy bottlenecks that currently constrain compute capacity. At the same time, the private sector must accelerate AI adoption by upskilling workers and making powerful models accessible to small and mid-sized businesses. And the country should deepen its collaboration among government, industry, and research institutions to reclaim open source leadership. Building the most powerful systems matters little if other nations deploy them more effectively. The greatest risk America faces is winning the AI frontier and still losing the AI era. The author, Eric Schmidt, is former CEO of Google and CEO of Relativity Space. According to Time, here are the AI companies to know. Graphics reporting by Taran Pillay. Okay, there are going to be 3, 6, 9, 12 companies to watch, according to this article. Model builders train the foundational AI models that power chatbots, agents, and other companies' AI products. OpenAI established 2015. The release of ChatGPT catapulted AI into the public consciousness. Now valued at $500 billion, the company continues to create leading models. Meta established 2004. The social media giant has spent billions on its Llama model series, which powers Meta AI and is found in Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Anthropic established 2021. Anthropic has distinguished itself from competitors with its focus on safety. Its Claude models consistently rank among the best available. XI, established 2023. Elon Musk's brainchild, XAI, created the Grok model series, which has been integrated into X and Grokopedia, an AI-generated Wikipedia competitor. The next category of four, computing providers assemble chips and other components into data centers, which other companies rent to run AI systems. Microsoft established 1975. With a huge cloud computing business, Azure, investments in OpenAI, and its own Copilot product suite, Microsoft wields immense influence in the industry. Google established 1998. Google operates across the AI stack. Its Gemini models are top tier and supported by the company's custom chips and cloud computing business. Oracle established 1977. Once dismissed as a legacy database company, Oracle is now a key infrastructure partner to OpenAI, building data centers for the $500 billion Stargate initiative. Amazon, established 1994. Amazon's cloud computing business, AWS, hosts AI workloads for thousands of companies worldwide. It also makes chips and is Anthropic's top external investor. And the third and final category of four, chip builders, make the specialized computer chips that model builders use to run their AI systems. NVIDIA established 1993. NVIDIA designs AI chips used by more than 90% of the market. In October, it became the first company ever to reach a $5 trillion valuation. AMD, established 1969. In October, OpenAI announced a deal to use chips from AMD, NVIDIA's main rival, an agreement that could give it up to a 10% stake in AMD's $350 billion business. TSMC, established 1987. The Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company is the world's leading contract chip manufacturer, fabricating almost all advanced chips used to train AI. ASML, established 1984, as the world's only supplier of extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, ASML, a Dutch company valued at more than $420 billion, is central to the AI supply chain. The Choice Person of the Year. This is by Sam Jacobs. And this is going to be hugely abbreviated. It's a very long article. Since 1801, American leaders have gathered in Washington, D.C. to attend the inauguration of a new president. It is a day of great tradition, one that often brings together the most powerful people in the country. Prominent at Donald Trump's return to office in January were the chiefs of U.S. technology companies, which long have led the world. But something unexpected was happening offstage. That same day, a little-known Chinese firm called DeepSeek released a new artificial intelligence model that spooked markets and led to a rallying cry from Silicon Valley. The next day, tech titans Sam Altman, Larry Ellison, and Masayoshi Son appeared at the White House with an announcement of their own. They pledged to invest up to $500 billion to build AI data centers around the U.S., calling the project Stargate. Those 2 days foretold the year to come: global competition, astounding innovation, massive sums of money, the alchemizing forces of public and private interests. This was the year when artificial intelligence's full potential roared into view, and when it became clear there will be no turning back or opting out. Whatever the question was, AI was the answer. We saw it accelerate medical research and productivity and seem to make the impossible possible. It was hard to read or watch anything without being confronted with news about the rapid advancement of a technology and the people driving it. Those stories unleashed a million debates about how disruptive AI would be for our lives. No business leader could talk about the future without invoking the impact of this technological revolution. No parent or teacher could ignore how their teenager or student was using it. These new tools can feel like magic. In the past few weeks alone, we've learned AI could facilitate communication with whales, solve an unsolved 30-year-old math problem, and outperform traditional hurricane prediction models. Person of the Year is one of media's longest-running traditions. We've come a long way since Time selected Charles Lindbergh as Man of the Year for 1927 in an effort to make up for the fact that editors had not put the aviator on the cover following his pioneering transatlantic flight. Since then, the recognition has evolved as its focus expanded. We've named not just individuals, but also groups. More women than our founders could have imagined, though still not enough. And, on rare occasions, a concept, the endangered Earth in 1988, or the personal computer in 1982. The drama surrounding the selection of the PC over Apple's Steve Jobs later became the stuff of books and a movie. This selection is the third in a series that has captured the key moments in the technological revolution of the past half century. Every industry needs it. Every company uses it. Every nation needs to build it. Jensen Huang, who leads NVIDIA, the world's most valuable company and one of the world's most influential AI leaders, tells Time, "This is the single most impactful technology of our time." The rise of the personal computer in the 1980s transformed the economy. The emergence of digital communities was captured famously and infamously by Time naming you, Y-O-U, as Person of the Year in 2006 with a mirrored cover. Hindsight shows how prescient those picks were. Now the social internet, made possible by personal digital devices, is giving way to a new era, the age of artificial intelligence. Person of the Year is a powerful way to focus the world's attention on the people that shape our lives. And this year, no one had a greater impact than the individuals who imagined, designed, and built AI. Humanity will determine AI's path forward, and each of us can play a role in determining AI's structure and future. Our work has trained it and sustained it, and now we find ourselves moving through a world increasingly defined by it. Even as the growth of these models relies on neural pathways that appear to copy our own, they learn, speak, argue, cajole. And yes, their ability to do these things can be as frightening as it is astonishing. We know that there is a difference between us and our creation. For these reasons, we recognize a force that has dominated the year's headlines, for better or worse, for delivering the age of thinking machines, for wowing and worrying humanity, for transforming the present and transcending the possible. The architects of AI are Time's 2025 Person of the Year. That article by Sam Jacobs was abridged. Okay, this is Entertainer of the Year, according to Time Magazine. It's a long article. I'll abridge it again. But the person is Leonardo DiCaprio. The article's written by Stephanie Zakarik, Los Angeles. At 15, Leonardo DiCaprio sat down with a pile of rented VHS tapes and gave himself a crash course in movie history. He'd recently and miraculously landed his first major movie role, playing opposite Robert De Niro, and figured he'd better brush up on the classics fast. He watched film after film, but no performance awed him more than the one James Dean gave in Elia Kazan's 1955 East of Eden as Cal Trask, the rebellious son of a disapproving, rigidly principled, Bible-thumping father. Craving attention, he's a cut-up, a jittery post-adolescent clown, a kid perpetually showing off on the monkey bars. If only his yearning could be seared right out of him, the way a teenager burns off calories. Dean's Cal is simultaneously self-protective and exposed. The tenderness he needs is elusive, a nameless butterfly heartbeat he can hear in the dark, but cannot get close to. DiCaprio could hardly believe the depth of Dean's on-screen vulnerability. As he says now, performances like that, that's what's intriguing to me, showing that or exploring that and not having that hardened shell. Could he do that? Could he be that? By that point, Dean had already been gone for 35 years, leaving behind only three credited film roles. And still he had unwittingly made an investment in the future of movies and in an actor he would never meet. As moviegoers or performers or both, we have no way of knowing where ghosts will lead us or of measuring their generosity. DiCaprio, now 51, has built a career many of his peers would envy. In that first film, 1993's This Boy's Life, adapted from Tobias Wolff's memoir, he played young Toby, who's nearly broken by the casual cruelty of De Niro's character, a nightmare stepdad who lives by a code of hothead masculinity. At the time, virtually no one who saw this performance could believe this kid. His juvenile delinquent swagger tempered by quizzical boyishness. He defined that fuzzy, confusing space between almost a man and still just a kid so purely you felt you were suffering through it yourself. Hollywood knew what it had. DiCaprio was offered what would have been life-changing money, certainly for a kid who'd been brought up modestly, as he had, often in rough L.A. neighborhoods, to appear in the Disney comedy Hocus Pocus. Instead, he played a mentally impaired teenager in Lasse Hallström's ardently unsentimental, independent, coming-of-age drama, What's Eating Gilbert Grape? DiCaprio, who's been nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 1, has a knack for making the seemingly wrong choice that turns out to be completely right. Perhaps just another way of saying he has good instincts and he knows when to follow them. He works with people he trusts. He invests in projects he believes in. But there are intangible factors, too. He has a face we do not tire of looking at. More than 30 years into a career built on making largely unpredictable bets, audiences still want to see him, maybe more than ever. Even as a washed-up revolutionary with iron butterfly facial hair, the character he plays in Paul Thomas Anderson's Shaggy Dog, Father-Daughter, Odyssey, One Battle After Another. DiCaprio's Bob Ferguson is now middle-aged and has gone into hiding. Even more importantly, he's a single dad, devoted to his teenage daughter, Willa, played by newcomer Chase Infinity. Like most dads, Bob's out of touch with kids today. As Willa heads out with friends, he grills her about where she's going and who she's going with. In the old days, Bob could be set on fire by the latest cause. Now that flame's just a flicker. And he spends his days dressed in a layabout's plaid grandpa robe, smoking weed. But there's still some fight in him. It's merely taken a different form. His fierceness, driven by the need to protect his child, is the motor of a movie that people have continued to see and talk about for months after its September release. You could argue, of course, people love talking about most of the movies DiCaprio has starred in, from Titanic to The Wolf of Wall Street to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. What does it mean to be the actor of the moment, one moment after another? And maybe the bigger question is, how does anyone pull it off? DiCaprio may have figured it out better than most, and still, he refuses to pretend he has the answers. DiCaprio does not exactly shy away from interviews, but he does fewer than you might think. And this time, when we sit down to talk, on an October day when he's recovering from pneumonia, no less, he explains why he cares so deeply about One Battle After Another. I've been thinking a lot about how often there have been truly original story ideas like this, with no link to anything historical, no past characters, no genre, no vampires, no ghosts, no anything, he says. It was somewhat risky for the studio to take this on, and what they're banking on, I think, is the appeal of Paul's storytelling and the source of fierce originality of his process. It's not lost on DiCaprio that One Battle is also about having something at stake, a core idea that seems to resonate with audiences in our precarious world. In addition to being a wily, entertaining comedy, the movie suggests that it's essential to have principles to cling to. It is about human beings in a world where we all feel stifled to say what we believe or stand for something because, you know, it is a scary world out there. DiCaprio makes a wholly believable dad, a character shaped, he says, by talking to Anderson about his fear of the future for his children, what it's like for him to be a father in the world we live in, what humanity and politics in the world are going to be like for his offspring. He loved working with Infinity, he says. She made it easy for him to slip into the role. You go, oh yeah, I'd stand in front of anything for this person, he says. She's just so incredibly good-hearted and sweet, you want to protect her. And working with DiCaprio, Infinity felt not only that sense of protection, but a warmth and generosity she was not prepared for. I mean, he's Leonardo DiCaprio, so it's a no-brainer that he's passionate about the craft, she says by phone from London. But getting to see his expertise up close and just observe him, and then find out on top of it that he's a very kind and genuine person. He was, she says, the perfect person to learn from. It was my first film set, and I did not know what to expect. And he would guide me in any way he could and offer advice. But also just him being there, making himself just a person to have a conversation with about anything. It was such a beautiful thing. When one battle after another opened, all the beard-stroking box office experts tsk-tsked loudly about how it wasn't on track to recoup what it had cost. As it turned out, though, the film has done just fine. By mid-November, it had made more than $200 million worldwide. No small feat in a here-today, streaming-tomorrow theatrical release climate, especially for an original movie clocking in at nearly 3 hours. Beyond dollars and cents, the more people talk about a picture, the more likely it is to have a long life in the cultural memory. Anderson wrote the script using oddball genius novelist Thomas Pynchon's 1990 Vineland as an inspiration. It's a comedy with grim underpinnings set in a society where violence seems to be the only answer. But it's also exhilaratingly weird. Where else are you going to find a group of rebel nuns known as the Sisters of the Brave Bearer, or see Benicio del Toro as a cooler-than-ice-cream martial arts instructor named Sensei Sergio St. Carlos? DiCaprio sees the appeal of one battle, not just as its star, but also as a guy who goes to the movies himself. Yes, he goes, all the time, he says. I just love that it's such a conversation piece, he says. In my community, people like talking about it, and that's one of the reasons you make movies. At the end of the day, it's like, wow, this maybe had a little effect on people. To make a movie as audaciously strange and as risky as one battle after another, a director needs a star who's on his wavelength. Anderson had long wanted to work with DiCaprio. It was just a matter of finding the right project. The two were ultimately brought together by the late Adam Somner, a first assistant director who had worked with each of them on separate projects. Anderson knew they would get along, he just did not know how well, or the degree to which DiCaprio would set the tone on set. If for the star of the movie, not to mention a very big movie star, and a big movie star for a very long time, your behavior informs everything. That gives an indication to the crew of what kind of film they've signed up for, Anderson says. His leadership means his presence, his availability, his unfussiness. It is that simple. There is no bull, SH space T. Promotion may not be any actor's favorite part of the filmmaking process, but especially for someone who generally shies away from it, DiCaprio seems completely at ease with this one. He's a person who still believes in movies and what they can mean to people, and he knows the effect they have is not always immediate. All of these are reasons DiCaprio has worked so hard to promote this movie, from appearing in TikToks with Infinity as director, to participating in dual Q&As with Anderson, to showing up with co-star Del Toro on Jason and Travis Kelce's popular New Heights podcast. It's worth noting again that one battle after another represents the sort of financial risk few studios are willing to take these days. And if no film is easy to make, this one came with particular challenges. We shot over 9 months, over 100 days, Anderson says. If that does not make you cranky, then I don't know what will. So, it's great that we're all still sort of in love with each other. people who care about movies, even as they watch the viewing experience, become eroded by the popularity of streaming, often wonder if we have any real movie stars left. DiCaprio is as close as we've got. He chooses his roles carefully, while also using his clout through his production company, Appian Way, to make movies he cares about. This is how he was able to swerve away from playing unthreatening, albeit undeniably charming, heartthrobs like Titanic's Jack Dawson or the pensive, impulsive Shakespearean Swain in Romeo plus Juliet. Those were great roles for a young actor. But DiCaprio entered new territory. You might call it the beginning of his great middle era, with his role as messed-up mega-capitalist and one-time Hollywood charmer Howard Hughes in The Aviator. From that point, he rushed toward, rather than away from, characters who are more complex, maybe even close to reprehensible, than they are likable. Whether he's playing the dazzled and dazzling social climber Jay Gatsby or Killers of the Flower Moon's Ernest Burkhart, a white man in post-World War I Oklahoma who, at the behest of his scheming uncle, attempts to murder his Osage wife, he finds the subtlest and most powerful ways of zeroing in on the murkier corners of masculine fragility. In this way, he wields influence like no other movie star. It is the chiaroscuro textures he's seeking, rather than the most flattering light. James Dean slipped away from us even before we could fully grasp what he meant. DiCaprio, on the other hand, has stuck around. We've had the pleasure of first watching him grow up on screen before growing into roles of extraordinary emotional complexity and delicacy, roles that confront various visions of adult masculinity, suggesting the grand range of what men can be, including how they can fail themselves and others. He built on a future on what Dean left behind and became a movie star in the process, but the kid who begged his parents to get him to audition still lives on. All he ever wanted to be was an actor. That article was abridged, written by Stephanie Zakarik, Los Angeles, with reporting by Simone Shaw. We've run out of time for this episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.